Welcome to the Life Science and Marketing Podcast, where we discuss marketing and career insights and tips with leading experts from across the globe. Let's join our host, Paul Avery, CEO of Biostrata, as he chats with our next life science marketing guest.
Today, I am lucky enough to be joined by life science business expert, Paul Kibax. Paul has been working at Malvern Panalytical in its various guises since 1997, when he joined as an application scientist. That was a few years ago, Paul.
Oh, it was a few years, yes. I've had children and they've left home in that period of time.
That's quite a stint, especially considering, because you started out with a PhD in physical chemistry, right, at University of Nottingham.
That's right.
And then you went to Malvern.
Mm. Yeah.
Wow. What a career.
My first job. This one company.
You just don't see that as often these days. I think it's brilliant.
No, we're jumping in right at the beginning. And it's to do with, to me, a job is something that I can't just do a job, go home and get all my kicks from home. I need to do a job where what I do means something. And what I've within this company, then I've had so many opportunities and learn so much and get to work with such a diverse range of customers. It's always been interesting. So then you go, okay, I'll stay here then.
Why not? You've had quite a lot of varied roles, right? You've been in product management, marketing and sales, and you've recently taken on the role of sales operations director. So congrats on that new role.
Thank you very much. Yes. So I came in as a technical bod. I did a PhD. Was doing technical support for our product ranges, and I went to a conference on drug delivery to the lungs. Still my favorite conference to go to, and I came away with thinking, hey, we can help these guys with the research they're doing. So I wrote up a visit report, and from that someone said, hey, would you like to be the product manager for that product range, and gave me the opportunity to step into product management. And so that was quite a shock, and I grabbed hold of it and said, well, let's see where it takes me. And it took me to being product manager of the most important product line in the company at that time. But then they said, oh, by the way, in two weeks' time, our marketing agency is coming on and you have to present to them about what's happening with the product range. And I went, marketeers? Wait a second, I'm a scientist, data and things like that. What do I know about marketing? And I was really scared. I thought, what do I do when this bunch turn up? One of the best meetings I've ever been in. I came out of that and my eyes were opened. I thought, wow, this marketing stuff, that's where you really connect to people. You know, we can share some stories. We can, and it's it opened up something that remains important to me now. A change. So that's when I started moving away from being a technical kind of person to being getting involved in marketing and sales pipelines now,
So you can really pin it back to that first meeting then, where you thought, wow, this marketing stuff's actually pretty interesting.
I think that because I've always been interested in the reason why things happen. I mean, that's what a PhD is all about. And when I got my PhD, the external advisor said, the thing that really comes across when they gave me it was, you're not great on the units you used in your equations, and there's some mistakes you have to sort out in order for this to be signed off, but it's the passion you have for what you are doing. You disappeared for 45 minutes. We were just sitting here amazed at what you were telling us about, in my case, the physical chemistry of what happens when you freeze ice cream. And that's always stayed with me. I need to know why I'm doing something. And that's what marketing is about. How do I connect that then to the people who are involved in things? Why is important that they come and work with me on this product? What can we do together? And I found a bunch of people in that marketing team that wanted to share that message and give us the channels to do that. And I remember now when we first published something, it was in a publication called Pharmaceutical Technology Europe, and I saw it in print, and it was with two key opinion leaders in the industry at that time. I went, wow, I never thought I'd be doing something like this, and never looked back, really. And it got a hugely positive response and linked to other key opinion leaders who wanted to work with us. So just ride the wave from there. It was good fun.
How did that shape how you went about your role then, because obviously you've come in as a scientist, you've started to get, you know, involved in marketing. Did the business kind of funnel you that way, or did you proactively start getting involved with certain projects? What did that look like?
The business funneled me in that direction, where you show an interest in wanting to connect to customers. That's the core of product management, isn't it? How do you bring that customer voice in and use that to inform the development of your product range, but also how then it's positioned and engage in marketing. The way it sent me was that I realized how important collaboration was. So I got the chance to set up projects, you know, and use equipment in projects that to determine, well, does this really release data that's important? And if it does, can we then work together in talking about that and seeing whether it's a broader requirement or a specific one? And I just love that opportunity to, you know, I work with some people who were deeply known as key opinion leaders in their sectors, and you present papers with them, you pinch yourself and you go, wow, this is starting to make something. And of course, that's where I learn, is from the people I connected to. I can think of the people who have had a huge influence on me because they spent time, and that, you know, I took a risk because their businesses were an early stage. They took a risk on me trying to work out whether this product worked, and together we did something which was successful for both of us. That to me, it sounds all very lovely, huggy, and everything, that we were trying to sell something and meet a business case. But it always feels better to do that through collaboration than just driving it hard. But there you go.
I agree. So it sounds like a really great experience. Mm. But I think one of the things I love doing on this podcast is looking at the story under the story. So tell me some of the things that didn't work out quite as well. Right. And what did you learn, or what do you do differently now?
Oh, things that didn't work out. Oh, you see, you don't try and keep those front of mind, do you? Oh, we did something crazy. It's got to be 8 or 9 years ago, where we ran something called we called it Project Bullseye, where we would go out and we were trying to hit a target. So we did these crazy, but we decided we will directly talk to customers. We got the message out there. And if they want a specific development, we'll do it as long as we've got a commitment to buy. And we have this matrix of opportunities. Some of them were very successful and are still in our portfolio now. And there are others where at the end of it all, you go, we thought that we'd be able to do what? There was a few sort of crazy devices that we decided that we would spend time doing, and it ended up being a one special. And so you end up with a relatively happy customer, but not something that's sustainable. And you go, oh, okay, then. So you burn some calories in some areas where you go, oh, my goodness. What convinced me to go down there? You know, having to then talk to a supplier we were working with and going, that isn't working. I'm sorry, we can't go forward. And that's hard, where you've made a commitment and you've created some energy. But of course, alongside that, the things that work. So you can't always tell the difference at the beginning.
No, I think that's key. Like, what, in that same vein, what things worked that come to mind where you're like, that was spectacular, and looking back, could you tell, or was it like serendipity, or like, yeah, any stories there?
Yeah, there's a great friend of mine who knows, maybe she'll tune into this podcast, a lady called Julie Suman, who set up a very small company looking at the characterization of drug delivery devices. It was set up in the basement of Maryland University, 4 people. And we went in and visited, and there was something about the way that she was talking and working with us where I went, you know what, we're going to take a risk and we're going to put a system in here and we'll do some work on it together. And it wasn't that much of a risk. She had actually been referenced by the FDA in some of his guidance. So I recognized the name. But at the time, you look at it, 4-person company in the basement of a university in the US, you know, and there are some people who went, is this really make commercial sense? That company now has grown and has been bought by another a drug delivery device company called Aptar Pharma, you know, and hugely influential team, you know, and we learned a heck of a lot together. And you go, did you know that right at the beginning? Well, I had trust that the person that I was talking to was being real, and I, you know, the rest is instinct. And I learned as much from her and her team who there's, I hope she learned from me and the broader team here at Malvern Panalytical. And we met up at a conference at the end of December last year as great friends and reminiscing about it all and realizing how far we'd come. So that's an example of the kind of, and there are other examples of that where we've worked with, contract research organizations or people doing PhDs where you go, oh, there's something in this. And, that's the kind of thing that makes you want to go out and do more.
I agree. It's funny how you sometimes get that feeling, don't you? And when you're working with people and you start collaborating with them and you think there's something about this idea or this, usually something about this group of people. And one of the reasons I've ended up trusting that gut instinct over the years is more because I think if you get the right people, even when they hit roadblocks, their passion and their ingenuity and their ideas and their desire to collaborate with people like yourselves, they'll get around it, right?
Yep.
And that,
but it's also realizing when that's almost the default. So sometimes I go through darker periods and internally we've had challenges along the way. And there's one of my colleagues, and she likes to she once sat down and I was going, oh, what's happening with this? And she said, Paul, sit down. Do you think people deliberately come into work to do a bad job? And of course, the answer is no. 99%, and even higher than that, of people come in and they're trying to do their best. They want to succeed. And now they might not get there in full meaning out of work because, it enables them to do other things, or they're really engaged at a personal level in what they do. Then you get different levels of commitment and need. But in the end, most people come in and they want to do something well. So if you approach things like that, then your gut's saying, I'm going to trust this person. It's likely that they're not trying to, do one over on you. Highly unlikely. So that I tend to default between that towards that view and be surprised when it doesn't work rather than the other way around.
On that vein, of all the things that you've done over the years, what do you love most about the roles that you've had?
People. Engaging with people, getting alongside people. I'm a great fan of direct engagement. If you wanted to know, one thing I'm well known for in the organization is believing too much in the power of webinars, for instance. And it's not because I think webinars are magic marketing. I mean, they were perhaps back in the 2000s when they were first around. They thought, wow, this is neat. But what's great about webinars is that's a direct connection to an audience you can't get close to by jumping onto without jumping on multiple flights. And it gives them a chance to listen and interact, ask questions, things like that. And I love that. I love it when you get an opportunity to do that and learn. That's critical to me.
Done poorly, I think webinars suck. Honestly, done well, they are magic. So what do you think makes a good webinar?
A narrative, and try not to make it last 60 minutes. And I don't often, I've done some webinars where I've got to the end of it all and gone, I've talked for a hell of a lot, but I wonder whether anyone's listening. So yeah, they can be done very badly. And also there's another thing I've learned and probably comes across as we're talking. I have a personality in a way, and a sense of humor, and those things are relevant, so be yourself. There isn't a corporate prototype for the person you want in a webinar. I don't want to knock that out of people. Yes, there's a topic and a message we want to get across, but the way I do it is completely different to my colleagues. And I remember working on that initially, we got a lady called Anne Verdon in our teams, who's now the product manager for the product range that I used to work with, or one of the product managers for it. And when she came into the organization as a technical specialist, she took on a series of webinars that I'd been involved with, a masterclass. She did it completely differently. And initially you go, oh, wait a sec, this is work. And then you go, no, the people are now getting something else out of this. And it took on its own life and direction. And don't forget your personality. Don't forget that, if you're not the kind of person who cracks jokes, do the thing that you like doing. And people respond to that more than if you're trying to be something you're not. I think people get a sense. It goes back to that gut instinct. Is this person real or not? I think, yeah, I've always felt bring something of yourself to it alongside the message. But there you go.
Yeah. I think it gives you credibility, right? Yeah. Being authentic in that way. Humor's the hardest thing to fake, right? If you don't have a natural sense for that type of humor in that type of context, right? Because you're speaking to people, which humor often involves a bit of risk, because sometimes you might say something and other people might not find it funny. I think you're more likely to get it wrong than right if you try and fake it, if it's not your natural way. It's better to find your natural way, right?
Yes. And humor is always a bit dangerous. Maybe more internally I use that than I do externally, but being personable and interested, you know, seeing that there's some excitement, honesty. There's something I've been looking at, and you know, there are things that go wrong. There are assumptions that the tool, you know, for instance, we're a scientific instrument company. You know, our techniques make assumptions about what they're measuring. Instead of trying to hide those and pretend it's the best thing since sliced bread, you know, or whatever, you say, oh, actually, this is the way that we do it. And you help people understand, therefore, okay, the scope of what I can understand from this approach is this. And so just be more open. And again, that's something that it's taken a long time to mature to that. Initially, I was, you know, specs and, you know, prove that we're the best, we'll be technical leader and that will get us where we want. And yes, that's important. It has to be something that performs, but much, much better to be open and then determine where you really deliver value that's differentiating, rather than in trying to create an artificial sense of where that is, in my view.
Mm. Yeah, or trying to be all things to all people, yeah, which is very, very challenging for any product or service, right?
And it will come as no surprise in the way of speak. There are two marketeers or two people that have influenced me through reading their books. One is Simon Sinek. His book, Start With Why, I went, wow, look at this. This is it. And then how he's taken that on with his with his books, you know, The Infinite Game, about, you know, that you're in for the long term, not the short term. How are you gaming the system to prove you've won? Actually, where are you with your customers over the longer term? Leaders eat last was there, you know, how are you enabling the team around you? What kind of leader are you? Are you yelling at them to say what to do? Are you allowing their personalities and their desires to help with where do they fit? And then the other one is, and people always laugh when I mention it, is Seth Godin, who, you know, the god of permission-based marketing, he talks about, you know, there's a tribe. I love that book, you know, tribes. There's a group of people who get you and a group of people that don't. You know, if you try and appeal to everyone who doesn't get you, you'll dilute the unique value or that you could offer to people. So focus on where your tribe is and respond to them. And look at how you magnify that engagement rather than worrying about all the people who are not bothered about what you do. You know, they're going to levitate to someone else, and you're not. And I always thought that was good advice, both personally. There are things I do well and things I don't do well. Well, allow the people who do the things I don't do well to step up and join with you rather than try and cover it all. And then in marketing, you know. Yep. Okay. You don't get it. I could try and argue you down, but what's the point? Life's short.
I had a different version of that through Marcus Sheridan, who is one of the first proponents of inbound marketing, and he's written a great book called They Ask You Answer. And I was lucky. I went to a speaking training session with Marcus. He's fantastic on stage, and I remember him saying, "There's always going to be a percentage of the room who don't like me. Don't like my style, don't like what I've got to say, completely disagree with me. That's okay. I'm not for them." And I think there's a lot of learning in that, because in life, there are times when, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking about what I think rather than what all humans think, but I think there's a pressure sometimes to like be liked or be right or be in agreement. And actually, sometimes people are going to disagree with you, and that's all right. And maybe sometimes they don't like you, and that's all right. And they won't like your style, and that's also all right.
Yeah. But also, that disagreement is a source of interest. So I've increasingly, sometimes I talk to people about, I want the the grit in a situation. And you know, the grit is the thing that polishes the stone, you know, get there, you know, reveals its beauty. But you know what? Grit is not nice. It you know, it has to do some work. There's going to be some things that you have to acknowledge or learn or realize you may have been heading in the wrong direction. All right? And I like those dissenting voices now. And it doesn't mean that I always handle them well. You know, I'm as human as anyone. Sometimes I feel hurt. But in general, if I just say something and everyone just nods, I go, oh, maybe where's the challenge? You know, I want you to help me determine what to do next. And that's, again, where having external support, we've worked together and you've helped me, that you bring in that other viewpoint that so you're not, you know, you're not just sat there believing your own narrative all the time. You're allowing it to be challenged. And it's hard. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm smiling whilst I say this because I've felt it work. But, yeah, sometimes it's tough. I've been in meetings with engineers who have told me directly what you're saying can't possibly be right. And the younger me would go, what do you mean? Of course I'm right, I'm the product manager. And the old me would go, okay, what have you spotted that you're really worried about? and try and jump to that response first. You may end up disagreeing, which is the next stage, of course. You know, okay, but we're going to go this way anyway. But, you know, it's good to
learn. I
wish
I could go back in time and give myself that advice and somehow learn that like 10, 15 years ago. Mm. I don't know if there's something of becoming a little older and maturing as a person that allows you to then embed that or try and embed that more of the time in your personality. But yeah, something to learn takes a while.
And if I go back in marketing, in the early days, I remember doing very defensive articles about the technologies that we were involved in because we felt that academics were taking pot shots at it and we'll go, okay, we're going to do a response. And they were really good. They were trying to be balanced, but it was like, I want to go and talk to the people who wrote that. Oh, hi, you've come up with this view. What is it? And, who knows? Maybe in the past we said something to them and they went, oh, a bunch of charlatans. I'm not going to listen to them again. And that they're carrying this view and they don't realize that we ourselves ask all those questions and there's an opportunity then to engage. I don't know. But, yeah.
Let's move on to science because it'd be remiss of me to have someone with your science background and not go a bit into science, right? So what's been the most interesting product, project, scientific area that you've worked on?
Oh, well, my what started it all for me was, I mentioned earlier on that I went to this conference, the drug delivery to the lungs. And I suppose at first there's personal interest in that, I don't like being injected. I hate injections. And I was sat in a room with a bunch of people who were telling me that my flu vaccine and future and other pharmaceutical treatments could be delivered by me just breathing something in. I went, this is a bunch of people I want to get close to. And then realizing that the understanding I had in physical chemistry and the understanding other people in this organization had in physical chemistry was hugely important to this group of people. So you go, okay, now I'm starting to understand some of the issues with developing these formulations. How are they handled by different patient groups? How do I ensure reproducible delivery? And then you start saying, I can apply this product in this way. And rather than just taking the first result out of it, I wonder what I can extract from the additional information in here. And then you head off and you talk to the experts and you realize you're onto something. And that was really, it played out over a period of about 5 years where we went from having a sense of what we might do to actually finding ourselves being referenced in guidance documents for what we did. And then the next stage was then we got a reputation for one technology and we found another one that fitted the same workflows. And we went out to that group and again, really worked out that how do you, okay, is this valuable and what do we need to do in order to be able to deliver that? And so being able to make a connection to another relevant measurement that was going to enable successful formulations to be made, in this case, for generic medicines. And you go, okay, that makes a big difference. And that whole approach of using physical measurement combined with my area of science, colloid science, and the interaction between particles in powders and in liquids, and then realizing, okay, that when we interpret the data from our systems with that kind of understanding, this is where we can take it. And of course, that informs the marketing message then. We talk about elements of that, and, you know, from the technical through to the what it means in general terms of work, customer workflows. But it all comes back to this science bit where you realized, okay, I know something about what happens in these formulations. I wonder whether I can partner in it. So that was really, really good to watch and to be involved in, and encourage other people in the organization to get involved in as well. So
I'm glad you mentioned the customer there, Paul, because it sounds like you must have had to work very close with the customer, right? Get under the weeds of the technical problems together. Is that how it all played out?
So spending time, we were doing demos, and then just during those demonstrations starting to ask questions. What is it you're looking for? What are you trying to do? Oh, okay, let's go and try it this way. I wonder if we can extract the data. And I remember working with a young researcher who I think now is leading a team in Novartis. I think that's where but he was doing his PhD at the University of Bath and he came up with a really neat way of using the data that we obtained. So we were making measurements. If you take an inhaler, you breathe on it, the drug is released over time, and we could track what was happening as it was released. And he looked at that data, and instead of averaging it, he said, I can use this information over time. And we're talking over milliseconds. And the way he cut it up and the way he compared then the output of different formulations unlocked a new form of analysis. We go, wow, this is quite... And you're right. You had to be in there listening to the problems, understanding what's the questions he's answering to then say, well, we could work it in this way. And then, yeah, it was his expertise that led us to a way of working. So it is deep with the customer.
I love it. It's like Sherlock Holmes style, right? Like, you've got to be in there together, problem solving. It makes me wonder, what impact has the pandemic had on this, right? Is it tougher to get out customer sites and do those demos and have those conversations? And if so, how do you replace that?
You're right. In fact, that's been a big question here. How do you... We pride ourselves in the expertise and linking that expertise through to the customer and understanding how you deploy the products. And when you're right, you can't go in and just have a cup of coffee with a customer. The way they've opened up afterwards, I think there's been that realization that, you know, time is precious and I need to, you know, there's some things I need to focus on. So do I need suppliers turning up at my door all the time? No. And I think it does come back to then realizing, as talked earlier on about the customer journey, and what are the needs beyond the purchase, which if I can meet those through different marketing and engagement approaches, I become more important to the life of the customer and how they use the solution that I've launched, which means you're more likely to be engaged in the next stage of questions that help you inform what you're going to do next in terms of development or in terms of what do we need to now talk about at the front end of the funnel? You know, what are the emerging questions? And there was a in one of my former teams, I worked with a lady called Hannah Yankovic. She's now the sector marketing director for our pharmaceutical group. She was really great at doing this, right? And here's an emerging area. So when the COVID vaccines came out, we saw our solutions being used, and she was the person who led alongside other colleagues, of saying, okay, what does that mean? How are you using it? What does that mean? Where does that connect in our portfolio? Who do I need to work with? You know, and just taking that message on. But it starts with realizing we're delivering a lot of this. I wonder what the value is. What are they getting out of it? So starting with the customer, and that then informed an approach at a portfolio level that maybe wouldn't have been resolved if we were just selling one thing all the time. So, yeah.
Sounds like it was really powered by curiosity, right? Like asking those questions, thinking those things through.
If that's a piece of advice I'll give, remain curious is probably it. Because if your curiosity is it drives your interest in the customer. You start asking questions about the customer rather than about yourself. You know, you're trying to bring them in, so that curiosity. And of course, if there's one thing that in my experience, customers love talking about is the project they're on, what they're doing, what their current concerns are, and things like that. And so just extract that. And it's not being done because I'm an evil marketing genius and I'm noting all this down and I'll come back to you about, so you've got to buy me after I understand all this. It's just natural curiosity, and then trusting your instincts and how you then bring that together. But that curiosity goes for, you know, how I do my job. There are people who come to me, have you ever thought of doing this? You know, and that's the only way to learn. So curiosity, step one, in my view. And from that, of course, you've got to frame that. You can't be endlessly curious. We are delivering something at the end. But to me, it starts with curiosity, and that defines the product and the message.
Perhaps that's why demo conversations are so great, because by definition, you're framed in a context.
Yeah.
But once you start getting into the application of a particular customer and understanding what they're trying to achieve, you're going to have that natural, curious discourse between you. Oh, why is that important? Why do you do it like that? What are you actually trying to find out? And then they're asking you questions. Well, why does the technology work like that? And it's like, well, because no one ever asked us to do it that way. And then the customer's like, well, what if I asked you? And you're like, then you've got to be curious when you get back to the office, because now you go ask an engineer, well, could we do it like that? Yep. All that good stuff.
And that's something that a few years ago now, the company sectorized, and we sectorized because we realized that it's good to be a generalist. And we still are interested in the connections between different markets that we serve. So I always joke that the science of creating a pharmaceutical tablet and where we engage there has got more in common with cement than a pharmaceutical scientist may want to admit, because there are some basic science relating to what we measure that connects the two. But you want to get deep into the workflows, and the workflows for cement development are completely different to the workflows for oral solid dose development, or which are completely different to lipid nanoparticle delivery development, you know. And so you go, right, okay, I need to get close to the customer and understand more about the questions they're raising. So that curiosity then becomes real. I've lost track a bit about what the original question is. You see how that happens? I just get carried away on one. Curious. I'm curious about how you're
that's
thinking
the goal
about
for.
It.
Yeah. That's the goal. I think what I love about what you talked about there is uncovering things with customers where they thought of things to analyze that no one until then had really thought that would be interesting. And finding new ways of analyzing things is interesting. But overall, just the passion for curiosity with customers. And I think that brings us on to sort of the last section of our conversation today about marketing and serving customers. And we talked about the pandemic and staying close to customers. And it makes me wonder, what do you think are the hardest things about being a life science marketer today?
Getting the attention. And definitely, I mean, you picked up on it. The traditional ways of staying in contact with the customer is just, things have changed, and where what we're interested in, what's the impact of, you know, digital? How can that enable us? Tools like ChatGPT both amaze me and scare me. I mean, it can write, I always prided myself and be able to write stuff. Well, it can write a PR in about, in several millionths of a second that really I go, wow, I might have taken an hour to get to there. You know, how do you then use these new emerging tool sets to retain a connection to an ever busier customer where realizing that their be-all and end-all isn't your product, that your product performs within a particular function they've got to deliver in their company. So how do you keep that relevant? And that, I think that's really tough. And the pandemic threw that into sharp relief. I think that getting that airtime, getting the chance to going and influence is now tough. And then mixing that up, what does it mean for the way you approach sales as well as the way you approach marketing, and not just taking all the burden on marketing? Don't overdrive on marketing where there are other approaches to maintaining contact.
Let's go deeper there, because I think that's fascinating. Because you're one of those people who's been in product management, you've been in marketing, you've been in sales, and you know, you hear things bandied about like marketing are from Mars and sales are from Venus and all these other types of things. What do you think are the hardest things about getting marketing and sales aligned, and sort of what advice do you have for companies trying to do that?
Oh, I mean, there are still deep reviews occurring within this organization about how we want to configure for the future, but I don't know. It's very easy for sales to say, oh, it's just marketing. Just turn it on and off. All right. I need more pipeline, please. Can you deliver it? Realize that marketing is something that it builds. It's a pipeline. You know, it takes time to take a position and to build on that and to deliver and some continual engagement. But you can't just jump to demand creation. How do you build the awareness so that sort of patience associated with it? But the other way around, realize that a salesperson, they arrive at an account and they need to very quickly come up to speed, because their personal skill set is arriving at an account, if they're seeing a person face-to-face or they're going to be on a call like this. Their skill set is getting that customer to talk and resolving what do they need so they haven't got time for a 52-page marketing guidance document about how they might do that. They need a very quick, get me up to speed, remind me of the key things, not everything, remind me the key, and then trust me that I'm going to come back and, you know, where are the things? They may come back with questions to technical support, to marketing or product management, but do remember that, you know, they haven't got infinite time. So be succinct and look at how you enable them, because it's a tough job, right? I mean, I've never been out in the at the sales front line. I've never had a target hanging over me. I've never had to try and prioritize, you know, focusing on the end of pipeline stuff whilst keeping the front end of my pipeline moving and things like that. That's tough. So, you know, work out how do you deliver the message to the right point in the funnel that enables that. Okay, I've picked up what I need. Now I know how to move it on. And there's some, a lot of focus on that.
Yeah, it sounds like actually just understanding each other's pressures and jobs better, right? I've never heard someone speak about the sales role and the challenges in it with that level of clarity. And I think as a marketer, I mean, I do marketing and sales as well, I guess, but yeah, as a marketer, really understanding that someone in sales, that if that's driving your behavior, the pressure, you might behave in a certain way. But similarly, as marketer, the levers that you have to pull to influence things like pipeline, they're not perfect, right? Like say we're doing inbound lead generation or even paid media tactics, we don't get to control the quality of the leads that comes in. We do get to try and filter them.
Yep.
But we don't ultimately, even with account-based marketing, we can't cherry-pick the absolute perfect lead every time, even though we realize that's what sales would probably like to get. So understanding each other's challenges a bit better might breed that bit of empathy we need.
I agree. And then working out then what does that mean overall? Because the bit, and I don't fully understand that, is then you've got all these products and you've got your overall brand position. Where's the company position? What does it, what do you mean? Where are you going as an overall organization? How does that influence the kind of people who start to become interested in you? And we recently did some VOC analysis that said, for instance, take sustainability. You could use that as a bit of whitewash on the, you know, oh, we do sustainability. Actually, we found out that there wasn't necessarily great understanding across many of our customers. And okay, if that's really important to us, that might not relate directly into the product ranges yet, but what education do we need to do? We all talk now about, with confidence, about scope 1, scope 2, scope 3 emissions and how, what we're doing in order to address those. Well, that's a partnership. And, you know, so there's some general positioning that's required that then becomes specific positioning when you're starting to engage with a customer with a need that then, you know, flows through to a commercial interaction, which is a point interaction now on a very specific. And you go, do I know how to connect all those things together? No. And I'm sure there are experts in marketing that, you know, will know how to look at general, you know, more about the science and the data of looking at general signals compared with specific buying signals compared to the now known pipeline dynamics and connecting it together. But it's something I've yet to learn, and it interests me, because I think then you can get it helps with defining your marketing mix more realistically.
Yeah, I think getting the balance between doing your best to model and understand the complexity of all of that so that you can try and improve in different areas is important, but also humans in a marketing or sales team probably going to operate best within fairly simplistic parameters just because there's only so much information we can keep in our heads at any one time.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So how do you processize and solve for the complex whilst building a system that's reasonably simple so us humans can drive it effectively, basically?
Well, an interesting example of that is what are you going to monitor in your CRM system? So as marketeers, I want to know everything about the customer who has suddenly appeared in my opportunity. You know, I've gone MQL and here's an opportunity. I want to know everything, which department they're in, which segment, sub-segment, instrument, measurement type, why they're doing the application, everything. So I can create, with Salesforce and everything, you can create as complex a form as you want. But it's going to be filled in by a guy who's just driven around, let's say, I'm going to take maybe an outdated model. They've been driving for 6 hours and they arrive home and they're going to fill in now, do you really need all of that to know about the customer? You know, and really asking the questions. So I've got colleagues of mine who go, oh, filling in all this stuff. It's usually, and I'd say, well, let's have a discussion about that. We asked for that for this reason. And then they come back and say, but you'll be able to tell that from this. Oh, that's a good point. And now in my current role in sales operations, I'm more directly in, okay, how does that work then in supporting, interfacing with marketing and supporting the salespeople in that? How do I get enough information about what's happening in my pipeline without just asking for the world and then it takes 16 hours to fill in the form? Well, that's very precise information, but not really very effective.
How do you deal with the noise in the system? I'll tell you a quick story. So at BiasCharter, we've got a fairly simple form-based system for you to contact us on the website. But then for people who are interested in our services, we send a short survey. Probably takes 2 minutes to fill in. And I use that so that when I have a conversation with a potential new client, hopefully I know a bit about what they're trying to achieve. But the number of times the thing we actually talk about or the thing the client actually wants isn't what they indicated in the survey, either because the survey is poorly structured maybe that I built, or actually it was the conversation that we had stimulated new ideas that were maybe even more important than the thing that they originally contacted us for. And I sometimes wonder, because humans are noisy systems, that actually they might fill in forms and answer questions, but sometimes until you have a real conversation with them, then you don't really know what they really are looking for. So how do you deal with the noise in the system?
Oh, well, there's been I've not been personally involved in that, but the optimization of the information that you obtain through I talk to the guys who do all this A/B testing and working out how you ensure that you get a conversion on a call to action, realizing you don't need to know the life story of the customer in order to do that. And I think you're right. Then it's in the conversation where the real need is. But then that depends on what kind of organization you are. We talk about, are you operationally focused? Are you product and technical focused? Are you customer focused? Of course, we're a matrix of each of those, but what is it that's important to you? If it's shipping very quickly and being operationally effective, and that's the way that you're going to deliver value, there's one set of questions. If it's technical leadership you're looking for, there's another set of questions that will be important to screening. If it's customer centricity, then it's another set. And what do I need in order to get into the conversation? And you can probably guess from the way I talk, I like getting to the conversation, and that's where the expertise then becomes incredibly important. So for you, your knowledge in marketing and approaches, your experience over many years is what you then bring to that conversation and unlocks what the customer really needs. And it's the same for us on analytical instrumentation.
I never really thought about it like that. There's only so much systemization you can do in terms of that information gathering by a form or survey, because actually the dynamic conversation and then our ability as humans with experience to react in real time, ask different questions. Yeah.
But also, what's your source of differentiation? Because that interaction is, if that's your source of differentiation, then name it, and that's the value. You're not you're not trying to screen rapidly. You're a kind of an organization that engages. Well, that's going to be a higher cost approach than other people, but you release value in a different way. So that goes back to what we were saying earlier on. Who is your tribe? Who gets why I exist, to quote the two authors that I mentioned earlier on? You know, and once you've isolated that, don't worry about the rest. You know, so... But it's interesting, where will digital take us? Because, you know, and what I hope is that where the newer tools that are coming through is it will just get you to the point where you start having that deeper value discussion earlier, because you were able to use a tool set to refine and send the customer in the right direction toward within your team. So that all a bit. So it's not about replacing people. It's moving the value interaction to a different point and not having to cover the basics all the time, which for many people, then they would see that as positive in their careers. But there you go. There's a sunshine view of how it could go. Of course, it could it could cause Terminator Judgment Day and as well. Who knows?
I'm definitely hoping for and leaning into Camp A on that one.
Well, yeah.
I want to respect your time, but there was one more question I did want to ask you, and it was about your best marketing tip, because off air, we talked a little bit about buying journeys and customer journeys. Yeah. So take us through what's been on your mind in that area.
My best marketing tip. Asked me that question beforehand, and I said, remember the customer journey. We talked about that. Don't finish at the end of the buyer's journey. Don't get bored about the message. Sometimes, because you're an organization and you know your tools or the products that you're selling very well, you can get to the end and go, oh, well, we must have to change that. We've been using that for a long time. And you know what? There are in certain industries, yeah, you're right, you've got to be constantly iterating that. But for us, there are some deep requirements of customers that have remained the same over time. So don't get bored about a message that remains relevant that you are repeating, because the audience is constantly changing underneath that. So we've done, for instance, I'll go back to my favorite tactic of webinars, where we've noticed the same people turning up all the time. So is that a poor sign or is that a good sign? Does that mean that but they're turning up unbeknownst to you with a room full of 20 people who are watching it because they know the value you can deliver. So actually the continuity of doing something on a regular cadence over a long term, we did those webinars for 8 years, is really important. So always remember that in amongst trying a new experiment, experimenting, I think. And then leverage the support of other experts. There's nothing, in my view, there's nothing better in life than going in there and going, wow, go for it. You've just come up with something. So you can't know it all. And if you try, you end up burnt out. And I've done that a few times, and I'd advise against people going there, really. There's a better place to be.
The world's... We're kind of surrounded by complex problems these days that you need the experience and expertise of people who've come at things from different angles. So you can't really replace that as a single person. You've got to build teams.
Yeah.
Paul, it's been absolutely fantastic having you here, sharing your experience. I really appreciate it. If people wanted to get in touch with you off the back of this, what would be the best way for them to sort of connect with you?
LinkedIn. That's a great way to contact me, because I always try to answer messages in there. So connect with me. Always tell me why you're connecting, because I don't like people who just, I don't know, coming through and just saying, connect with me. I like to have a reason, but then I always try and chat with people and exchange ideas there. And then outside of work, one of my passions, which we've not got into, is photography. So if you want to find out what I do outside of work, where I engage in the creative side that I discovered when I realized that being a technocrat being technical wasn't everything in life, then look for Dr. Kippy on Flickr. Yes, one of the ancient social media platforms, which I'm still committed to. So, but Dr. Kippy on Flickr on Instagram, you can see what I play with when it comes to cameras and to getting out into the wild. So.
I love that. I'm definitely going to go and take a look. Thanks again for your time, Paul.
Well, cheers. Thank you, Paul. Enjoy chatting. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Life Science and Marketing Podcast. For your regular dose of cutting-edge life science marketing insights, don't forget to subscribe. Join us again in 2 weeks for another engaging expert discussion.